Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the second hour. Ooh, almost dropped my Sharpie. You don't want to do that. Sharpies are not the thing you want to drop. We're going to be hearing from Rudolph Giuliani, who's tossed his hat into the ring. He's decided he will be running for president. There's no real surprise there. He was already, before an announcement, any kind of announcement, polling very well for 2008. Now, he might be a watershed. Who knows? Think about this for a moment. Is it possible for a Republican candidate who is pro-choice to win the nomination for the presidency? Here he is one. He's a pro-choice Republican candidate in 2008. I want to know, would you vote for Giuliani in either a Republican primary or in the presidential election if he made it that far? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727 are our call-in numbers during audio open lines for the next 20 minutes. You can also email us right here in the studio with your response to that question. Would you be voting for Rudy if he made it through? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Now, I said before the break, I misspoke. I said he was pro-gay marriage. I'll let you judge that for yourself. We're going to hear what he has to say about both abortion and gay marriage. This is an interview earlier this week with Sean Hannity of Fox News.
Earlier today, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani filed a statement of candidacy papers with the Federal Election Commission. Mayor Giuliani joins us now for Hannity and Combs exclusive. Should I say congratulations, Sean, or condolences?
A little of both, but mostly congratulations. This is a wonderful thing to be, you know, organizing and putting together, and it's a little very humbling to think that running for president of the United States is for a kid from Brooklyn. It's quite a step.
You are then officially running to be the next president of the United States.
Well, we still have to formally announce it and do a few more things, but this is about as close as you're going to get. I mean, we did everything you have to do, I guess, legally to do it. Then you still have to make a formal announcement, do things like that.
Are you in it to win it?
Gosh, yeah. I mean, that's the only reason to do it. I mean, first thing you have to do is say to yourself, you know, what can I bring to it? What can I do that's, you know, different, or how can I make the country better? How can I improve it? And I think that the experiences that I've had as mayor of New York City, United States attorney, all of them very, very strongly kind of in the executive area, where you have to have leadership and organization and focus, and having dealt with a city that was in really bad shape when I took over, and that had to kind of turn around, I think it gives you the background to approach it and to feel pretty comfortable that you can make a difference.
Democrats were predicting this back in November 14th, as a matter of fact, and they said it's unclear whether or not Rudy Giuliani will be able to just explain away the fact that he's consistently taken positions that are completely opposite to the conservative Republican base on issues they hold near and dear. Is that accurate?
I don't think anyone's campaigned much more than I have for Republican candidates going back to 1998. I mean, I've been in 45 states on behalf of 200 candidates. All Republicans, sometimes differences on issues here and there, but same basic philosophy of a strong foreign policy, being on offense against terrorism, smaller government, lower taxes. And in my case, those are things that I did. Those things I just mentioned to you are not just things I believe in. I mean, I lowered taxes in New York. I reduced the size of government in New York. I took a $2.4 billion deficit and turned it into a $3.2 billion surplus. And I reduced taxes over 23 times.
That's pretty good.
Now, those are the things he has in common. Those are the things he has in common with the average Republican candidate out there. But the question wasn't, what do you have in common with him? The question was, and this is the specter raised by, at least in Hannity's viewpoint, the Democrats who predicted this long ago, is what about being on the wrong side of most Republican or conservative voters on the two issues that they haven't talked about yet, that they will talk about in a minute, abortion and gay marriage? Now, they go on to talk about those controversial issues with the common ground that he's already laid out. He's pro-choice. Would you vote for Rudolph Giuliani in a Republican primary? Would you vote for him for president in 2008? Our in-studio email address, it's audio open lines this Thursday, the 8th of February, issuesetc@kfuo.org, and our call-in number 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727.
So, I mean, those are very conservatives. And on the issues, where, you know, sometimes, of course, there are disagreements. I mean, you never agree with any one candidate 100%. I don't agree with myself 100%.
No, I don't.
You don't even agree with me 100%.
Not 100%.
And I agree with you almost 100%.
Almost. That's cool. That might get you in trouble. That's the first campaign gaffe.
Not quite.
Let's talk about some of these issues, controversial issues. You'll be asked about them a lot in the campaign.
Sure, I just was in South Carolina.
Where does Rudy Giuliani stand on abortion? And do you think Roe v. Wade is good law, bad law?
Where I stand on abortion is I oppose it. I don't like it. I hate it. I think abortion is something that... as a personal matter, I would advise somebody against. However, I believe in a woman's right to choose. I think you have to ultimately not put a woman in jail for that. And I think ultimately you have to leave that to a disagreement of conscience. And you have to respect the choice that somebody makes. So what I do say to conservatives, because then, you want to look at, well, okay, what can we look to that that's similar to the way we think? I think the appointment of judges that I would make would be... very similar to, if not exactly the same as, the last two judges that were appointed. Chief Justice Roberts is somebody I work with, somebody I admire. Justice Alito, someone I knew when he was U.S. Attorney, also admire. If I had been president over the last 4 years, I can't think of any I'd do anything different than that. I mean, I guess the key to it is, and I appointed over 100 judges when I was the mayor, so it's something I take very, very seriously. I would appoint judges that interpreted the Constitution rather than invented it, understood the difference between being a judge and being a legislator. And having argued a case before the Supreme Court, having argued in many, many courts, is something I would take very, very seriously.
So you would look for a Scalia, a Roberts, an Alito?
Scalia is another former colleague of mine and somebody I consider to be a really great judge. I mean, that would be, you're never going to get somebody exactly the same, and I don't think you have a litmus test. But I do think you have sort of a general philosophical approach that you want from a justice. And I think a strict constructionist would be probably the way I describe it.
Is Roe bad law?
I think that's up to the court to decide. I think that it's been precedent for a very, very long time. There are questions about the way it was decided and some of the basis for it. At this point, it's precedent. It's going to be very interesting to see what Chief Justice Roberts and what Justice Scalia do. Justices Scalia and Alito do with it, I think probably they're going to limit it rather than overturn it. In other words, they'll accept some of the limitations that different states have placed on it or the federal government has placed on it.
Partial birth?
Partial birth abortion, I think that's going to be upheld. I think that ban's going to be upheld. I think it should be. And I think as long as there's provision for the life of the mother, then that's something that should
be
done.
There was a misconception that you supported partial birth abortion.
Yeah, well, if it doesn't have provision for the life of the mother, then I wouldn't support the legislation. If it has provision for the life of the mother, then I would support.
Parental notification.
Parental notification, I think you have to have a judicial bypass. If you do, you can have a parental notification. I think the court, I mean, that's the kind of thing I think the court will do with abortion. The other thing I should emphasize is while I was the mayor, there's a column that's just written about it. Abortions in New York went down and adoptions went way up because we worked on adoptions as an alternative so that there'd be a real choice. So that ultimately you respect a woman's choice, but it should be a real choice. Adoption, or if they make that choice, I don't think the criminal law can interfere with it.
I think conservatives would be happy with choices of Roberts, Scalia, and Alito, but there might be some slight disagreement. There will be a disagreement on abortion. Does that concern you?
But there'll be disagreement on other things. I mean, there are always disagreements. People, and then some people just won't be able to vote for you. You got to live with that. I mean, the reality is you got to be yourself. You got to be who you are. You got to be honest with people. If your views change on something, you got to be willing to express it. When I was mayor of New York, my views changed. I began as mayor of New York City thinking that I could reform the New York City school system. After 4 years, I became an advocate of choice, of scholarships and vouchers and parental choice, because I thought that was the only way to really change the school system. When I started as mayor, I didn't believe that. When I went through 3 or 4 years of experience, that's what it taught me.
All right. They're going to get to gay marriage here in just a moment, but let's summarize what he said about the abortion issue. And the question I have for you is, would you be voting for him in a Republican primary, Rudolph Giuliani, or would you vote for him if he made it as far as the nomination for the president? He says he's personally against abortion, but he supports keeping it legal. He says he would appoint judges like President Bush has appointed when he had the opportunity. When asked if Roe is bad law, he kind of whiffed on that one and said, well, the court will decide that. Of course the court will decide that. He says he's against partial birth abortion, but he thinks any restriction of it, any ban on it, has to have a provision for the life of the mother. And he says he's for parental notification as long as there's a clause in the parental notification law that would allow judicial bypass. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, and our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. So from what you've heard so far on the abortion issue, he is personally opposed but publicly in favor of legalized abortion. Would you be voting for him? I want to hear from you. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Here's what he has to say about the issue of gay marriage.
And I think you have to be willing. You have strong ideas, you have strong views, but then you have to be willing to also look at experience.
Let me ask you about gay marriage. What do you think about the definition of marriage? Should it be between a man and a woman?
Yeah, marriage should be between a man and a woman. Here's exactly the position I've always had, and it's the same, and I feel the same way about it today that I did 8-10 years ago when I signed the domestic partnership legislation. Marriage should be between a man and a woman. It should remain that way. We should be tolerant, fair, open, and we should understand the rights that all people have in our society. And I thought the best answer was domestic partnership as a way of dealing with that, so that you recognize the rights of people who are gay and lesbian and protect them. But marriage should remain between a man and a woman.
All right, so there are his positions. He is pro-choice but personally opposed to abortion, and he believes that marriage should be between a man and a woman, but he has already, as mayor of New York, allowed domestic partnerships. I guess you might call them civil unions. Full rights and privileges to gay couples, gay and lesbian couples, but not the name marriage. All right, you've heard from him on the issues. He's probably going to be answering those questions again and again and again as he heads toward the Republican primaries. Would you be voting for him in a Republican primary? Former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Or email us, issuesetc@kfuo.org. How important are those two issues for you? Because as he's made his case on the other issues concerning so-called conservative voters, like war on terror, domestic issues, taxes, size of government, he says, look, I'm as Republican as you get. I'm Republican with a capital R on those issues. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Or issuesetc@kfuo.org.
How is Mayor Giuliani's position on abortion any different from Senator John Kerry? He was personally opposed to it, too.
That's a great question. I mean, think about it. Go back. We probably still have this hidden away someplace. But John Kerry, during the presidential campaign of 2002, was very clear that he believed life began at conception. He considered himself, he called himself pro-life. He said he was adamantly opposed to abortion. He thought it was a great wrong and evil. He even said at one point he considered abortion the taking of a human life. But he says those are my private opinions and I can't impose them either as a legislator or as a president on anyone else. They're articles of faith. So he says he still wanted abortion to remain safe, legal, and rare, to use the mantra of former President Bill Clinton. So how is Rudolph Giuliani different than John Kerry on that issue? Are you willing to give Mayor Giuliani a pass because he's a Republican? That's the difference between, at least on that issue, the difference between John Kerry and Giuliani is that John Kerry was a Democrat saying exactly the same things that Giuliani is saying as a Republican. Let's go to the phones. Dan in Altenburg, Missouri is on the line. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Hey, we're dropping the ball here as Christians, and we need to let everybody know that we're not going to allow abortion to continue, and voting for a moderate is not the answer. And that's what Giuliani is, a moderate. And if we're going to change that, we all got to get together and vote for the to end the abortion in the country.
What if your choice is Giuliani versus whoever? Not in a primary, but actually in the election. What do you do, Dan?
Have Giuliani or
Giuliani versus any Democratic candidate. What do you do?
Well, I don't know any Democratic candidates are going to do away with abortion. I guess there's some out there, but you know, if nobody's going to do away with abortion, then I'll have to get away from my theology and go and look at the business sense of it. But when there's a clear choice between killing unborn children and anything else, I don't care if he's Democrat or Republican, I'm going to vote for that because that's just strictly against, you know, our work created in God's image, and we want to protect that.
Dan, thank you very much. Thanks for listening down there in Altenburg. What about the rest of you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. What do you think about Giuliani's positions on abortion and on gay marriage? He said, look, let's keep marriage between a man and a woman, but let's allow, and he already has in his capacity in elected office before, let's allow for what he called domestic partnerships. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. They're already running. So the questions I'm posing to you have to do with how would you vote if this is the guy you're faced with when you walk into the ballot box in November of 2008? Well, there's some discontent in the rank and file of the GOP over certain presidential candidates, the ones that have announced, not all of them, but some of them. Here's the story about that discontent from CNN.
Giuliani is getting a lot of attention because there are so many questions about some of the other Republican candidates that are in the race.
Next track there, Buzz. Just track three, I believe. All right, thank you. Here's that story from CNN on GOP discontent over its presidential candidates this early in the race.
Start naming names in the top tier of Republican presidential candidates, and somewhere you will hear a conservative object. Rudy Giuliani, for a woman's right to choose, gay unions, and gun licensing.
If you have a Giuliani who's pro-abortion, who's for gun control, is pro-homosexual, stacked up against Hillary Clinton, who is pro-gun control, pro-abortion, pro-homosexual, for redefining marriage, what's the difference?
Mitt Romney, for a woman's right to choose until a relatively recent conversion.
He's saying a lot of the right things, but you know, a lot of things coming out about him that are troubling. It appears that maybe his campaign, his whole cycle, could be like a Chinese water torture. I mean, one news item drips out after another, and it's going to drive people crazy.
And though anti-abortion, John McCain favors some legal rights for same-sex couples, but he draws fire from the right for seeking compromise on Senate battles over judges and authoring campaign reform that limits third-party advertising.
The McCain-Feingold
yes.
bill kept us from telling the truth right before elections, and there are a lot of other things, and I pray that we won't get stuck with him.
The top three Republican candidates for president, and not a purist among them.
I think there is some anxiety among Republicans that there are problems with each one of these candidates.
The objections are less vocal about Mitt Romney than about McCain or Giuliani, but talk with conservatives in South Carolina, and you will hear Romney between the lines. State Senator Kevin Bryant backs Kansas Senator Sam Brownback.
In my opinion, he's a true conservative. He's the same now as it was several years ago. We see a very clear, constant record on the conservative issues.
It is an article of faith that no Republican candidate can get through the primary season without the support of social conservatives. It helps explain Senator McCain's attempts to patch up relations with Jerry Falwell after a nasty dispute in 2000. And it explains why Rudy Giuliani touts other parts of his resume and why Mitt Romney explains.
On abortion, I wasn't always a Ronald Reagan conservative. Either was Ronald Reagan, by the way. But like him, I learned with experience.
Conservatives insist there is no way the party will ever nominate a candidate who favors abortion rights. To do so, said one, is to invite a third party. Candy Crowley, CNN, Washington.
So are you one of those who are discontent with the presidential frontrunners in the Republican Party, at least so far? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuezTC@kfuo.org. It was raised there that, you know, the conventional wisdom is that without conservative evangelical voters, you can't do anything. They're the gatekeepers for presidential candidates. We're going to test out that theory a little bit in about a half hour here on Issues Etc. We'll talk with Dr. John Green of the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life about the real role of religion in the 2006 election. Jen in Vegas writes this, "Well, I don't really want to vote for him." I think she's talking about Giuliani. "I don't think he's any more conservative than Schwarzenegger." Of course, he's the governor of California. "He's a fiscal conservative, which is important, but the abortion/gay issue bothers me. It comes down to the fact that it is still very early in the election cycle, and we don't know who else is out there. I'd vote for him over Hillary or Barack Obama if that was the final ticket, but I'd rather see someone else on the Republican ticket. I don't like his position on either the abortion or the marriage issue. He's trying to pacify everyone, and personally, I don't like it, but that's, yes, personally, I'm against it, but there's more issues out there, too, and it depends on how far he gets. Not likely to vote for him unless or until he gets the final ticket," says Jen in Vegas. All right, what about you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Up next, here's Al. He calls from his car. Hi, Al.
Hi, Todd. How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Good. I think Christians will end up voting for him. Basically what you got. Giuliani's job is not to be a spiritual leader. He's to be the leader of the country. And I think you give it another 2 years, this country will be into even deeper threats of terrorism, and you're going to find overriding issues that will force Christians, rather than take the liberal choice, they're going to go to a moderate choice. That's just the way it's going to be.
So you think they'll be choosing the lesser of two evils, in essence?
They're going to be, yeah, they will. And as moderate saints, I think by 08, we'll be willing to swallow a moderate versus a liberal.
So, all right. Okay, Al, thank you very much. That's what a lot of people are saying. What's DB saying? Calling from his car. Hi, DB.
Hey, Todd. How you doing?
Doing good.
I'm a Reformed Presbyterian, so I hate to put myself into Christian right because they align a lot of things with Scripture that I don't, cynically speaking. But I'm a pretty hardline Republican because, for the most part, I think that the Republican Party stands far more for my personal values than the Democratic Party. But at this point, it seems like I can't tell the difference anymore. I'm looking at these Republican candidates, and I'm not willing to vote for someone who's Republican just so I get a Republican in the White House if his values are almost identical to those in the other party. And so I'm wondering, I've never been a third party person because I've just felt like that's never been a very successful move, but I'm beginning to wonder if we don't need a third party made up of people not only that claim to hold to those values, the true pro-life values and such, but people who really believe vote and act according to what is right and good and really act according to their conscience rather than just whatever the political flow is.
All right, DB, thank you very much. You know, I've been reading some history about this leading up to the Civil War, and the issue then was slavery. And you know what? How they finally did get a third party on that issue who decided to just come out and say, we want to deal with the issue of slavery when all the other parties were saying no. You know what that third party was? It was the Republican Party. That's when it began. Well, we don't have a third party yet, so we're going to have basically two choices. And we'll keep talking about it. When we come back from this break, Dr. John Kent joins us from the University of Illinois in Champaign. We're going to talk about the social and economic impact of legalized gambling in all its forms. Stay tuned.
The message is the mission. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hello, this is Kay Meyer of Family Shield. God's Word says, one generation shall praise thy works to another and shall declare thy mighty acts. Are you telling your children and grandchildren about the praiseworthy deeds of our Lord? Want to learn more? Then join us next time as I interview Dr. Dick Hardell. Our topic, Tell the Next Generation.
Family Shield, Saturday mornings at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. It's a long-standing tradition at AM 850 KFUO. Every Sunday morning, we carry two live worship broadcasts from area churches. At 8 o'clock, we carry the service from Peace Lutheran Church in South St. Louis County. The Reverend Dennis Castens is the pastor.
Then at 10:45, we broadcast our second service, this time from Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, where the Reverend John Temple is the senior pastor. If it serves you well, listen to one or both of our Sunday morning worship broadcasts here on AM 850 KFUO.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Family advocates, internet service providers, and even the U.S. Justice Department are quick to criticize the proliferation of child pornography on the internet. Prompt action is a little harder to come by. The Securing Adolescents from Exploitation Online, or SAFE Act, is a bipartisan congressional effort to streamline the process from detection to prosecution. Steve Jordahl reports.
If the SAFE Act becomes law, internet service providers like MSN, Earthlink, and Yahoo will face criminal prosecution if they fail to report child pornography on their networks. Bill sponsor John McCain of Arizona says child porn is a massive problem.
The production and distribution of these images is estimated in the United States to be at least $4 billion annually.
He wants a uniform reporting effort from all ISPs.
There's a lot of good websites like AOL and others that routinely do that, but there are thousands of internet service providers that do not.
The ISPs are required to send the information to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, who would in turn notify the Justice Department. Kathy Ruse of the Family Research Council says that's not the end of the bill's reach.
It requires the Attorney General to every year tell Congress how many reports it's received and what the nature of those reports are.
The Justice Department is under fire for the pace it sets in prosecuting child pornography.
So it's very clear that through this law, Congress wants to keep a close oversight of what is happening online with regard to child pornography.
McCain expects the bill to pass easily in both the House and the Senate. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
One of every five pornographic images on the internet is of a child. The penalty for an ISP that refuses to comply with the reporting requirements is up to $300,000. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mark Hanneman. Join me and my co-host Michelle Bauer this week on Life Revised to see if you pass the test as an overprotective parent. If you want to put a GPS tracker on your child or go with them on their sleepover, you might be an overprotective parent. Discover ways to ease your fears and allow yourself to enjoy your child's independence. Join us this week on Life Revised, because life is a series of revisions.
Saturday mornings at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Concordia Publishing House and Issues Etc. are pleased to offer our Book of the Month for February, titled A Seminary in Crisis. It's a history book that you won't be able to put down. A Seminary in Crisis tells the story about the battle for the Bible in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in the early 1970s. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. The book, A Seminary in Crisis.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to be talking about the social and economic impact of legalized gambling. I was reading about how people who get rich with the lottery, this was last week in the paper, people who get rich on the lottery, not all of them have their lives ruined by the sudden riches, the sudden rush of riches. There's a lot of money out there in gambling. How does it affect society? How does it affect us economically and socially? We're going to answer that question here for the next half hour of Issues Etc. with Dr. John Kent. Issues Etc. is underwritten in part by Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, where every summer they hold a two-week residential program for high school-aged men who are considering studying for the pastoral ministry. The residential program is called Christ Academy. It involves classroom study with real-life seminary professors, involvement in the worship life, and some entertainment for those men during those 2 weeks. June the 17th through the 30th this summer at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. You can find out more by calling Concordia Theological Seminary, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, or just look for the Christ Academy logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Dr. John Kent is professor of business administration at the University of Illinois in Champaign. He joins us to talk about legalized gambling. Dr. Kent, welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, always glad to be with you, Todd. Thanks for inviting me.
Overall, is gambling good or bad for society if you just are crunching the numbers?
Well, it's really a no-brainer. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure this out. The people that sponsor the gambling take all the money, and everyone else is just feeding the pot. So the winners are the ones who own the gambling, the casino owners, and all the rest of us are losers, including those of us who don't gamble, because we're paying for it in higher taxes, about $200 per person per year just to allow our neighbors to gamble because of the increased crime and social costs.
How did we get from, I was thinking about this earlier today, when I grew up in Dallas, Texas, admittedly the Deep South, but gambling was unheard of. And if you wanted to gamble, you'd go to Atlantic City or Vegas or maybe a few other places. But how did we get from that to national lotteries, state lotteries, casinos on every body of water, even if they have to dig a trench and fill it up with a garden hose? How did we get to that?
We call them boats in a moat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's like real estate is location, location, location. Gambling is corruption, corruption, corruption. Because the academics who are objective will tell you that this is econ 101, this is good policy 101, it's business 101. Gambling all is really derogatory. It carries a lot of social negatives with it. But, you know, people didn't believe. I was on your show and your radio station years ago, and we were talking about this when they were casinos were first starting to come into Missouri or making these propositions. And the academics were just uniformly saying, this is just not good economics. You're going to hurt your economy. You're going to corrupt your government. And we're seeing a lot of that occur across the country with the criminalization. I don't know if you noticed recently, but it's always been criminal to gamble on the Internet. That was never decriminalized. And now the U.S. Congress has just really ratcheted up the ante, so to speak, and has made it even more illegal to gamble on the Internet.
So you talk about the ABCs. In terms of the consequences of gambling, what are those?
Yes, sir. You've really done your homework. It's the A stands for new addicted gamblers, just like drug addiction. You've got about 1% of the population who will become hooked once you bring in new casinos. It goes up to 2-3% of the population. And on top of that, there's another 4% approximately who become problem gamblers. The B stands for new bankruptcies, up 18-42% around casinos and slot machines as people lose their money. And then the C stands for new crime and corruption. Crime rates go up 10% the third year after these establishments open, and then continues up after that. And we taxpayers are paying for all of this.
Well, let's look at C first. What kind of crime goes up?
Well, the first types of crimes that go up appear to be property crimes. As people lose their money, they start stealing. Usually they start stealing from family and friends, so it's kind of a hidden crime to begin with. And then they'll get into embezzlement. They'll steal from their employers. They'll steal from banks. We're just seeing a whole rash of these things occur as gambling spreads across the country. There's a good organization there. If people want to go online, they can go to a group right there out of Missouri called CasinoWatch.org. That's CasinoWatch.org, and they've got just blurb after blurb after blurb about embezzlements, prostitution, all these new problems which are developing as people bring in this gambling. And most communities are not voting for the gambling. For example, in the state of Illinois, we have never had a statewide vote on gambling since the lottery, but we have casinos everywhere. We've got all kinds of gambling. This is a top-down push by the legislature, and I think if you follow the media, you know we don't have a particularly ethical governmental system here in Illinois.
Agreed. Now, what about the lottery? I mean, I don't buy lottery tickets. I prefer to spend my money in more fruitful pursuits, and other than inconveniencing me and buying a Slim Jim or something, waiting behind someone who's got a stack of these things, I don't have a lot of exposure to it, but what are the social consequences that we can measure with regard to statewide lotteries?
Well, that's a great point. You say you're standing in line at the convenience store waiting for somebody to buy 10 or 20 or 30 of these tickets. Those are people who are hooked on this. They have the peel-off games so that people can gamble more quickly. These oftentimes are the studies all show that these are the people who can least afford it. These are the poor, the desperate. These are people who may even be below the poverty level. And for government to be preying on its own citizens, to have government as a predator on its own citizens, raises bipartisan social and ethical concerns for Republicans and Democrats.
The picture that is painted, Dr. Kent, is that the average person who engages in gambling is just like you and me. They're not the addict. They're not the, you know, and then they have their slogans like, bet with your head, not over it. They show, you know, at least the gambling concerns seem to show some concern about problem gambling. But how big of a problem is gambling as an addiction?
Well, it's like drug addiction. And in fact, these slot machines are known as the crack cocaine of creating new addicted gamblers. This is a recognized addictive behavior pursuant to the American Psychiatric Association. We had a National Gambling Impact Study Commission that started back in 1995, concluded in 1999, and they confirmed much of what I said earlier about the academics saying this was bad economics. And the National Commission called for a moratorium on the expansion of any type of gambling anywhere in the United States. And it did kind of grind to a halt for a while, and then we had the Twin Towers 9/11 tragedy. And you know what the gambling guys did? Instead of trying to help the economy out, they went to Congress and they smuggled through the back door a $40 billion tax break for themselves for slot machines. Now, this is a real patriotic group. And then they used the same tragedy to leverage casinos into New York and then into Pennsylvania. But basically, there's a big backlash all across the country against gambling, and so they've had to go overseas, and they're now trying to open the doors in other countries, saying, oh, it's working in the United States, so why don't we do it in your country?
How is it usually sold? I mean, these things don't happen under the cover of darkness, but how does a region or a city that heretofore does not have any form of legalized gambling, how is it usually brought in, presented, and eventually established in an area?
Well, you've got, I mentioned the National Gambling Impact Study Commission, which was just swept through Congress with approval. The only people against it were the people from Nevada and from Atlantic City. And this commission confirmed and basically said the ABCs, you get new addicted gamblers, new bankruptcies, new crime and corruption. And so all the academics are saying don't do this. The National Commission is confirming that and saying don't do this. So why are governments still doing it? You raise a great question. Corruption, corruption, corruption. And it's really been an eye-opener for a lot of people, I think, to see how the money that these gambling interests can bring to the table can simply overwhelm the process and create this positive PR spin, which is totally bogus. There's no academics behind it. As a matter of fact, they're out there like the tobacco industry and some others approaching academics saying, well, you know, what will it take for you to say that this is a great thing to do?
What about the education promises? I mean, we were told in Missouri that the money from this, the profits, which are promised to be huge, would benefit schools and education and help improve the standards of education in the classroom?
Well, it's another shell game on the public. The academic studies have been done on this. It shows that those states that have lotteries and have gambling have less real money, bottom-line dollars going to education, than those states which have less gambling or no lotteries or no gambling. Money Magazine even did a state-by-state analysis, a very comprehensive report, state-by-state, and reached even more dramatic conclusions and said the people who've got gambling here are just being ripped off, pretending that education is benefiting. Well, they may put a little money into education, but then they take twice as much out the back door. So education has been a net loser. And if you go to any grade school in this country, you look in the World Book Encyclopedia, it'll tell you the same thing. So there's no excuse for any educator out there to be saying, well, gambling is helping education, because it's so bogus that it's in the World Book Encyclopedia.
We're talking about the social and economic impact of legalized gambling. Dr. John Kent is our guest, professor of business administration at the University of Illinois in Champaign. You can join us, of course, with questions and comments. Our email address here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. And our call-in numbers, 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. Let's talk with Mike in Kansas City. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi, Pastor Todd. Good to talk to you again. I would hope more people would consider supporting Issues, et cetera. It's a good program. What I wanted to ask you about concerning gambling had to do with all these multi-level marketing schemes that are so popular. Here in Kansas City, you can listen to Christian radio, and you hear these advertisements for them all the time. And I know that's not exactly gambling, but if you, they're so synonymous in that your profit is directly related to the loss of multitudes. And when you set up that kind of a system, you're damning yourself. And one of the prime examples of that would be the country of Albania. Just 10 years ago, the country of Albania, the entire economy collapsed as a result of people gambling on these multi-level marketing schemes. I wonder if you might talk about that.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike. Your thoughts there, Dr.
Great point. Great point. Gambling produces no product. It's just money coming out of the economy, and that cannibalizes, and that's an academic term, gambling cannibalizes the consumer economy. But the listener also raises a couple of other great points, and that is that no other company could advertise like the lottery does, because it would be there'd be no truth in advertising. It would be false advertising. It would be fraud. So basically, the lotteries are government-sanctioned fraud upon the consumers, and they're pursuing this PR with taxpayer dollars. No other company can do this, and other companies cannot use the marketing techniques that gambling can. Well, how do they do that? Well, they simply get special exemptions for themselves that say, well, it's okay because it's gambling, it's just a special thing, and we're going to go ahead and do this. But no other company can do this.
Is it significant, real quick before we go to the next caller, is it significant that we've gone from talking about gambling, now the term of art is gaming?
Oh, absolutely. You've got to change the way people think about things, and you have to soften it, and you have to sell it by saying it's going to help education, or it's going to help the elderly, or it's going to help the environment. These are called the E's that are used to ease gambling into the economy. Anything it takes to persuade people to bring in the gambling. But why didn't we have gambling back during the 30s when there was the Great Depression? Because you can't gamble your way to prosperity, and every economist in the world knew that, and knew that you couldn't open up casinos and counter a recession or a depression. They actually cannibalize the economy, and they actually throw fuel on recessionary types of trends and fires. So all of this is not going in a good strategic direction.
Eric calls from his car. Thanks for waiting, Eric.
Yes, I was wondering, all the profits and the losses and those types of things that go into the gambling industry, has there ever been an investigation or a look into where those profits are ending up, and all this money has to be going somewhere, what's happening to it?
All right, thank you, Eric.
Well, the most egregious example involves the tribes. The tribes are now bringing in $22 billion a year, and only a few tribal members are benefiting from this millions of dollars. 90% of tribal members are still in poverty or in close to poverty situations. And so the government is almost afraid to ask, because they're afraid of the PR consequences of challenging Native American and tribal leadership and saying, where is this $22 billion a year going to? And if you follow the press on it, you just press on gambling, do a Google search on it, you will see scandal after scandal after scandal all around the world and all around the United States. But for some reason, the public just hasn't gotten tired of it yet, or hasn't gotten the message to realize that this is poor government, poor economics, poor ethics, and eventually it's going to hurt everybody.
Bankruptcies is one of the things that's the focus. There, it's the B of your ABC. And are we talking here about merely personal bankruptcies? Is this an epidemic? What's the would you kind of demonstrate the scope of the problem of bankruptcy here?
Well, we're talking personal, professional, and business bankruptcies. It only takes one employee to get hooked on gambling to take down some very large businesses. We've seen some major banks in the last 20 years, and they don't like to advertise it, but they have had terrible embezzlement due to their employees getting hooked on gambling. And there have actually been some bankruptcies of banks because one or two employees, usually just one, gets hooked, and they're very good at hiding this. That's one of the things about being an addicted gambler, is that you're dealing with money, you're very good at manipulating the numbers until it's too late. And so we see businesses going belly up, we see banks having problems, and it's because we're getting more and more of these addicted gamblers, and they're walking off with $100 million, $20 million, they wind up in jail, but that doesn't do any good to the thousands of employees that they're throwing out of work when they take down these businesses. And then, and actually, the initial studies were done by the American banking industry. They said, we're seeing all these increased bankruptcies around the casinos and the gambling areas. Let's figure out what's going on. And sure enough, it was attributable to gambling. They said it was the fourth leading cause of bankruptcy in the United States. That was 10 years ago. I imagine it's probably up to third or second by now.
Someone's going to inevitably say, oh, come on. I mean, if you do it right and you get it and it's all done well with the proper regulation and the gaming commission and everything, like they do say in Nevada, then you're going to have a situation like Las Vegas where the town is booming, no one pays personal property taxes, there aren't income taxes. 55% of the people in that town own their own homes. Who can argue against the benefits of legalized gambling in a city like Las Vegas or a state like Nevada?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you bring up Las Vegas, because Las Vegas leads the charts in college dropouts, suicides, non-participatory voting, crime issues. It's the number one destination for criminals on the run. It leads every negative social category, leads practically every category that there is, and it's attributed to gambling. But from an economic standpoint, all that money is coming out of Southern California and the surrounding states. Money doesn't grow on trees. If you've ever been out there in the desert, you'll know that money doesn't grow on trees. It's shipped in from Southern California primarily, and there are economic reports showing that California loses the equivalent of 160,000 jobs per year with the billions that are dumped into Las Vegas. Now, they're creating some jobs in Las Vegas, absolutely, but it's nothing compared to the number of consumer jobs that are being lost from the surrounding states.
How much of the gambling industry is the casual, occasional gambler? And how would you respond to someone who says, well, in the case of the person who makes a trip every 2 years out to Vegas and loses $150 but gets a nice hotel room, it can't be that harmful. How do you respond?
Well, that's exactly what the industry wants to promote as their PR. But they know that it is this small percentage of addicted gamblers, about 2% of the public, and problem gamblers, another 4 to 6% of the public, who are contributing 65% of the money that's dumped into these places. So 90% of the people that go out there are gonna lose a little bit of money, and they're not gonna be out of control yet. But remember, the whole industry is geared toward bringing people back. And the more people go back, the more likely they are to become hooked on this or to become problem gamblers. So most of the money, even in the lotteries, is coming out of a very small percentage of the public. Now, what government would legalize a drug, for example, that would absolutely devastate or even kill several thousand people across the country? And yet government is out there legalizing gambling, which is noted for ruining families, increasing suicides, and totally devastating types of social consequences.
In terms of its social and economic impact, is it equal to or greater than the illegal drug problem in the United States?
If it hasn't passed the cost of the drugs, the war on drugs, it will. It is absolutely huge. People don't realize how huge it is. The industry is spending billions and billions of dollars, many times taxpayer dollars, to keep the PR lid on things and to say, oh, it's just fun and games, it's just entertainment. But it's not. They're selling a recognized addictive activity. And for governments to be promoting this just to get some so-called tax revenues is really an ethical problem. Former Senator Paul Simon said they used to call these things bribes. Now they call them political donations.
let's look at this kind of in a what-if scenario. If gambling had not gone from being something isolated to various cities and Indian reservations in the past to being ubiquitous, just tell us, what do you think the U.S. economy might look like?
Oh, if this, what we should have done is, you can really pump prime the economy if you would just get rid of all of this gambling. And it would just raise the economic level and the wealth level of everybody in the country. Instead, we're going in the wrong direction. We're just enriching all of the owners of the casinos and the racinos and the slot machines at the expense of the most poor and the most desperate people. Let me give you one example of how powerful this industry is. Back in 2000, the two presidential candidates spent about $100 million together to get their nominations as presidential candidates for the 2000 election. That same year, the tribes out in California spent over that amount, $110 million, to get a proposition through the California voting mechanism to allow tribal casinos in California. Now, when you can put more money into a referendum on gambling to promote gambling and to allow gambling, then both presidential candidates need to get the nominations of their parties, you have got an industry which is totally dominating states and, in many instances, federal decision-making.
Dr. John Kent is professor of business administration at the University of Illinois in Champaign. Very quickly, with only 30 seconds, where would you point our listeners to for resources on the truth about economic social consequences of gambling?
Great question. I would go to casinowatch.org, right there in the Missouri area, casinowatch.org. There's also ncalg.org. That's the National Coalition Against Legalized Gambling.org, ncalg.org. And the final one is citizenlink.org/gambling research. That's by Focus on the Family. That's citizenlink.org/gambling research. It's got the national report on it and links to national studies.
Dr. Kent, thank you for being our guest again.
Thank you. Always glad to talk with you.
When we come back from this break, Dr. John Green, he's a senior fellow for the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life based in D.C., is going to join us. You've heard Dr. Green all over the place when the question is, what is the impact of the religious voter? What is the impact of the values voter? When that is the question, he is the one there providing the answers. We'll get some answers from him on the role of religion in the 2006 election and the projected role of religion in the 2008 elections. When we come back from this break, that's the first part of our third hour of Issues Etc. The second part is Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. We definitely want to hear from you. It'll be your chance to vote for your favorite soundbite from this week's Issues Etc. audio coming up in a half hour.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues Etc.